Hello and welcome to Viewpoints. My name is Boris Hussain. I'll be with you for the next half hour. On today's show, Canadians will need more hours to qualify for employment insurance. The measures implemented during the early stages of the COVID-19 epidemic come to an end on September 24th.
It could end up being pretty devastating for a number of people that are working in those seasonal industries.
Cost of living is straining households and volunteer organizations across Canada, and Revelstoke, BC, they're also feeling the pinch.
What's really important to remember is that those who struggle the hardest and struggle the longest. So while it may feel like things are back to normal, they certainly aren't for the most vulnerable in our community.
A Metis artist travels to different parts of the country to present her Hope and Healing Canada installation. She makes her 108th stop in Kingston, Ontario. Karen Musna had a moving conversation with her.
We have to find some sort of positive or we wouldn't go on. Like, mankind wouldn't go on. We couldn't. We physically couldn't go on if we didn't have some sort of hope that things were going to get better. Most of us are working towards something better. And without hope, you can't heal. You just stay in that same cycle of pain. But if you are hopeful, yes, you still have the pain, but you can move forward.
And on our Periscope, we'll take a peek at stories produced by our journalists posted in Ontario, Quebec, and New Brunswick. Nice to have you with us.
This is Erica Butler in Sackville, New Brunswick. You're tuned to Viewpoints. Check out our stories online at canada-info.ca and follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI.
Qualifying hours for EI will drastically increase on September 24th. This will likely penalize seasonal workers across the country. Many are calling on the federal government to keep the COVID-19 recovery measures in place. The president of the Nova Scotia Federation of Labor, Danny Kavanagh, says the changes could end up being pretty devastating for a number of people working in seasonal industries. Many hope that Ottawa will wait until the current revamp of the EI program is completed. More on this with Ed Halverson in Liverpool, Nova Scotia.
The Nova Scotia Federation of Labor is calling on the Canadian government to extend COVID recovery measures for those on employment insurance until a new system is in place. The current temporary measures are set to expire September 24th. When they do, the number of hours required to be eligible for EI benefits will increase from 420 to as many as 700, depending on what part of Nova Scotia an applicant lives. President of the Nova Scotia Federation of Labor, Danny Kavanagh, says some Nova Scotians struggle to get enough hours to qualify for EI benefits due to the seasonal nature of their work.
In both the eastern and western region of this province, it could end up being pretty devastating for a number of people that are working in those seasonal industries.
The federal government is currently working to revamp the EI program, and Kavanagh says it would be better to maintain the lower 420 qualifying hours until the new system is in place. Kavanagh estimates anyone in western Nova Scotia, including Queens, will need 630 hours to qualify for EI after September 24th. He's also in favor of raising the minimum wage from $13.55 to $20 an hour to bring it closer to the approximate $23 an hour cost of living announced by the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives last week.
Whether employers are like it or anybody likes it or doesn't like it, workers have been falling behind for a number of years, and I think that we're just going to have to back up here and make sure people are getting paid a decent wage for the work they do, and that employers see value in their workers to be able to pay them that wage. And those that can't keep up, I guess, are going to fall behind, meaning the employers. We're just not going to, I don't think, be able to, you know, see every business survive. And that's the reality we're in today.
Kavanagh is urging workers to contact their local member of parliament to ask them to put pressure on government and keep the existing temporary COVID measures in place until his group and others can work with officials to modernize the EI system to reflect the realities of 2022. I'm Ed Halverson.
Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI. Listen to all our news online at canada-info.ca.
Cost of living strains households and volunteer organizations in Revelstoke. Community Connections recently held its annual food drive at a time where more and more people in Riverstall, British Columbia, and around the country are feeling the strain from the high cost of living. The food drive hasn't been held in the last 2 years because of pandemic restrictions. Some 250 volunteers go door to door in each neighborhood, collecting donations of non-perishable food items and cash. The Community Food Bank Drive makes up for a quarter of the stock that the food bank stores and distributes each year. On the ground, Teresa Hamilton says things are tense. She volunteers with Soup and Smile on Mondays at the United Church and for the Community Connections, among other things. Megan Dooling met up with Teresa Hamilton in Revelstoke, BC.
I mean, every month our numbers fluctuate as to how many households we serve. In August was one of our highest numbers served in that month, other than what we saw through the first few months of COVID, of course. That set an all-time high. But high numbers. We're seeing new registrants per month in the 20 to 40 households per month. And so that's showing us that a lot of new households are experiencing food insecurity maybe for the first time.
Melissa Hempel is the co-director of community outreach and development at Community Connections, and she's in charge of the food programs. During the food drive, volunteers go from door to door, collecting non-perishables and cash donations, accompanied by emergency vehicles, sirens blaring to let people know to have donations ready.
Well, cash is awesome because that lets us buy food in bulk and have a consistent supply of options for our clients. Food drives are great because they bring in a variety. And so anything non-perishable, we can't accept dented or expired items or homemade items. But anything from rice to pasta, pasta sauce, soup, canned veg, kids' snacks are always appreciated, cereals. Basically, anything that is shelf-stable would be awesome. It's becoming more and more challenging to provide the things that these households need, both because there's more households in need and because the cost of food has gone up so much. And so that cost of food is affecting households, but it's also affecting our ability to purchase food for our clients.
In an attempt to address the cost of living, the provincial government announced what they call targeted investments.
At the start, I want to say that we've been experiencing unprecedented inflation, not just here in British Columbia, but indeed internationally.
That's BC's Premier John Horgan. He cited the high cost of groceries and fuel and listed the ways his BC Liberal Party has supported with the cost of living during his term.
But despite our best efforts and the pandemic coming upon us and Putin's invasion of Ukraine has put us all collectively in a difficult spot.
The provincial government is increasing the climate action tax credit for a one-time payment that will be four times the normal amount to be deposited in October, reducing the rent cap for the next year to 2%, so rents can't rise with inflation next year, and increasing child benefit payments between January and March 2023. Teresa Hamilton volunteers around Revelstoke with Soup and a Smile and Community Connections, among other things. She said there's a palpable tension in town.
I love to volunteer because it means that I'm creating the community that I want to live in every day. But I definitely see a lot of the same people as I volunteer. And all of a sudden, there is a lot more people as well.
Erin McLaughlin is the other co-director for Community Connections. She looks after the outreach services, so emergency shelter, rent supplements, and support for people who are experiencing poverty. She's been with Community Connections for 13 years and says it's strange to watch Revelstoke boom in one eye and see more people struggling in the other.
Where we're in a town that's very quickly becoming gentrified and with lots of people that are buying property and building huge houses and fancy cars. And, you know, so there's this contrast. You know, we see the folks that are struggling and we see the community sort of booming in certain areas. And it's strange. Like, it's strange to live and see both.
A recent survey done by Community Connections of their clients showed that of the people who responded, over 64% have lived in Revelstoke for over 10 years. People who access the food bank either struggle with systemic poverty or situational poverty. Situational means they're in a pinch and need a bit of extra help, maybe just once or twice. Melissa Hempel says if they happen to be driving a nice truck or wearing a nice jacket, it doesn't mean they don't need help.
And I can confidently say that people who make the effort to show up at the food bank do so because they need some support. And people don't necessarily advertise their challenges in life and what they're going through that might bring them to our doors. When folks arrive, we create a welcoming environment for them. We don't want people to not access a food bank because they don't feel like welcome.
Hempel says she can't keep track of stats on household poverty because they're changing so quickly.
The pandemic just shifted so many things. Food insecurity grew so dramatically through the pandemic, and how people are responding or recovering from that is really varied. And a lot of people did really well through the pandemic. Good for you. That's great. But a lot of people have been able to get back on their feet since. But what's really important to remember is that those who struggle, struggle the hardest and struggle the longest. So while it may feel like things are back to normal, they certainly aren't for the most vulnerable in our community.
I'm Megan Dooling.
And our Kingston, Ontario journalist Karen Musna had a very interesting conversation with Métis artist Tracy Mae Chambers. Chambers is traveling to different parts of the country to present her latest installation entitled Hope and Healing Canada. Chambers just made her 108th stop at St. Lawrence College's Kingston campus in Ontario. The installation will be shown on Portsmouth Avenue in front of the St. Lawrence College until the end of October. Helena Neveur, knowledge keeper at St. Lawrence College, says this project is leading up to the Truth and Reconciliation Day coming up on September 30th. Neveur says this art exhibit will bring up this conversation not only for students, but for community and family. We wanted to have Tracy here at her exhibit to talk about reconciliation and what it means to repair damage between two parties. In Native education, adds Neveur, we really want to get that across in our circles. Karen Musna is with Tracy Mae Chambers.
Hope and Healing Canada. So this is the name of the installation that we're standing right in
Every
front of.
Every one of them has the same name, which is a hashtag, purposefully.
Yes, I was going to ask, exactly, the hashtag, is there something there with that? Yes.
Absolutely, I don't have to put a capital C on Canada. So, yeah, there's no capitals in hashtags. And that way I don't have to make Canada something that I don't think it is. So I do that, it's purposeful. So, yeah.
Okay.
No C, capital C.
Okay. So I know that the message here is to do with decolonization and also to reflect on Truth and Reconciliation Day, which is only a couple weeks out.
Yeah.
But tell me a little bit more about what kind of led you to starting this piece in the beginning.
At the beginning, I was trying to figure out how to express how I was feeling about, you know, being sequestered at home during COVID, which I'm sure you were dealing with as well, everyone was. But the first children were, the first graves were identified at Kamloops. And I wasn't sure how to express that through, I'm a sculptor, but I wasn't sure how to address that through sculpture without being really confrontational. So this medium lends itself to being non-confrontational, right? You can't pissed off at me if it's yarn, right? So yarn was the right choice, and red was the right color because of what it represents. You know, it's a powerful color. So that's why I chose red. So I was thinking about connection, and that Canadians or settlers were quite surprised by the fact that there were graves at these places, which really was stunning to me because all of those communities knew they were there, like the indigenous communities knew that they were there, and that they were undocumented. So and not, I mean, there's not even markers at a lot of these graves. That's horrific. And families don't know where their children were buried, and it just is horrific to me. So there didn't seem to be a connection. And if I pass you a piece of string and you hold one end and I hold the other end, there's a connection, right? But if I cut that string or any of the strings that are in this installation, what happens? It falls apart, right? And a community is built upon us all working together, and that is, I guess, me lacing my fingers together on the radio doesn't really give much help, but that's what I'm doing, in case you were wondering. I'm lacing my fingers together. And when we do that, it becomes unbreakable. I can't rip your shirt on my own, right? I can't physically do that because the material is so strong, because it's interlaced threads, right? One single thread is not strong, but when they're sewn together, they are, right? And as a community, that's what we need to do, is communicate and have some connection between us, right? Like between your community and my community, between settler communities and your community, right? Like that there needs to be connections between that, but there isn't, right? A lot of times there isn't, and there needs to be.
You know, I'm just finding it fascinating how you reflect on such tragic events and yet create something, a beauty out of it.
And isn't the beauty the long-term goal, which is connection? Mm-hmm. So if you can't, we have to find some sort of positive, or we wouldn't go on, right?
Yeah.
Like mankind wouldn't go on, because we would just be, you know, we physically couldn't go on if we didn't have some sort of hope that things were going to get better, and that we were working towards, most of us are working towards something better, right? So that's what I want to work towards, is that.
Well, right? I guess that ties directly into the name of the piece, yeah. Hope and healing.
Yeah, yeah. And without hope, you can't heal, right? You just stay in that same cycle of pain. But if you are hopeful, yes, you still have the pain, but you can move forward, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, as far as I'm concerned, anyways. Yeah.
Oh, beautiful. And with Truth and Reconciliation Day coming up, is there something that, you know, perhaps you'll be reflecting on, or you encourage others to think about on that day?
I think I always, when I'm creating, I'm always thinking about how spaces can be torn down and built back up again. Just like sometimes we lose a friend because we have a fight, right? But that doesn't mean that it's not fixable, right? We can fix that. Or we don't want to talk to our mother anymore, and we're pissed off at our mother and we don't want to talk to our mother anymore, but it's still fixable, right? If we both work together, we can figure it out, right? It's painful, and it might be uncomfortable. It's necessary, right? It's necessary. And I think that's what I will be focusing on, and I hope Canadians are focusing on, and the Prime Minister is focusing on, and not at a beach somewhere. That it's an important day. It's not a celebration. It is a day for reflection and figure out how we can move forward together. Yeah. And it's not just words. That's another thing. It isn't just words. It can't be just words. You can't say we're not going to be racist and then be racist, right? The words are nothing. They're just nothing. The actions are what's important. And you know that firsthand. The actions are what's important. The words are absolutely meaningless unless there's action. Right? Right. Yeah. You know that.
Excellent. And so, I mean, this has been going up all over Canada, as far as I understand.
Yeah. So this is the 108th since July 21st, 2021.
When you put something like this together, you know, are you perhaps working through some of your own things that might hit close to home for you as well?
I think certainly, because I was adopted out of my family, mm-hmm. right, and adopted by a Scottish family. Yes, I would have lost all of my culture, right, and wasn't able to gain that back again until much later in my life. So yes, I'm always thinking about that, my own separation to my own culture, which is difficult for anyone, no matter what culture they're in. It's difficult to be away from home, to be away from your parents in another country, to be away from, it doesn't matter, it's all difficult. So yes, it definitely comes out in the work. And it comes out in the work in another way because I've worked at residential schools, like I've done work in. And so, I mean, that's coming into my mind when I'm working as well, is how it felt to be in that space, which is highly unpleasant, right? So, mm-hmm. and so incredibly sad. So yes, it's my own feelings are most certainly coming into it.
When you say you worked at a residential school in terms of installations,
yes,
or...
Yes, of course. Okay. I'm sorry. Yes, thank you. Thank you. Yeah. You're so smart. I've created in those spaces. Is that a better way to say that? Yeah.
Makes sense.
So I've created in residential schools. Therefore, I can remember how I felt in those spaces and how I felt about it.
And how would you describe that feeling, if you could?
Hopeless. Isn't that horrible? It was hopeless. Okay. Ryerson, you know who that was, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so he, at Black Creek Pioneer Village, there's a schoolhouse there that was the template for residential schools. So he created a schematic. I don't know what that is when you're making a building, but mm-hmm. he created this, and then they built this building. So I was in that building to create, and as I was working from the back to the front, I realized how little the chairs got. So there are these little tiny chairs, and you realize that it's little tiny people that are in those little tiny chairs. Mm-hmm. But they're not at home, and they're not there by choice. So it was the chairs. I know that sounds ridiculously stupid, but it was and I lost my shit because I was so upset, because I realized if someone took my five-year-old, I don't have a five-year-old anymore, but when I had little people and they just came and took my child, how would I feel? Like, how would that feel? I had a really hard time working there because that's what I was thinking, is how little the chair is. You know, usually a chair shouldn't set you off, but it set me off because I realized how little it was. Yeah.
And this Pioneer Village, where is this located? Just here?
Here in Toronto.
Toronto, okay.
Or it's not here in Toronto. In Toronto, mm-hmm. yeah. Black Creek Pioneer Village. Okay. So, yes, that's... it's just is what it is, right? Okay. So you've got to... keep moving forward, right?
For sure. Yeah. Thank you very much for having this discussion today.
Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI. Listen to all our news online at canada-info.ca.
And it's time to take a quick peek at some of the stories produced by our journalists all over the country through our Periscope. We first turn to Halifax, Nova Scotia, where journalist Sarah Gouda had the opportunity to chat with Ryan Goulin, the bassist of the Saskatchewan-based rock band The Sheepdogs. They just released their latest album, Out of Sight. The band was the first unsigned band to make the cover of the Rolling Stone magazine.
We've been really fortunate. We've obviously spent a lot of time touring around the world. We've played all over the place. We have multiple platinum records and gold records, and we have 4 Juno Awards, and all that stuff is whatever. And I think just we feel very fortunate and very happy that we're able to make the music we like and tour around and do what we do. And like we talked about, be back doing what we do, because it's been sort of a very strange time for everybody. And I think it's refreshing to go and have these moments and experiences that we can all share together, which we haven't been able to before for the last little while.
And now to New Brunswick, where Erica Butler interviewed Sackville resident Susan Amos, who just published a book on the town's oldest foundries entitled Foundries of Sackville, New Brunswick. This year marks the 170th anniversary of the Fawcett Foundry and the 150th anniversary of the Enterprise Foundry. Susan Amos.
Each foundry had a different whistle, so that wherever you lived, when you heard the whistle, you knew, okay, that's not mine, or yes, that's mine. They began the shifts with the whistle, and they had lunch breaks with the whistle, and the end of the day, that was how people knew who were waiting for their family to come out of the foundries. It was the whistles that controlled everything.
In Ontario, the 153rd Six Nations Fall Fair makes its full return to the community. The fair is Ontario's oldest and longest-running Indigenous fair. In Ashwaukan, Andrew Dow spoke with Lindsay Hill, secretary of the Fall Fair.
You know, we've been here for 153 years and look forward to the future years as well. But I feel this is a super important event for our community. I, as a child, remember going and having, really very good memories that I still to this day remember. And me now as a mother, wanting my children to have those same memories, it was a part of growing up for me. So definitely that's close to my heart. And I that's personally how I feel. And I know, there are others who feel that way as well. It's very good to see, the community come out. And I think by the community coming out, you can see that it's very important. It's an important event for the whole community as well.
And in the province of Quebec, the city councillors of the small town of Sutton decided they will be reinforcing a decade-old bylaw addressing light pollution. The bylaw was adopted in 2013, but has not been well enforced over the years, says Mayor Robert Benoit, interviewed by Taylor McClure. The town officials say exterior lights have to be directed towards the ground and at a certain height. Inspectors have already visited homeowners and different companies.
To the owner to be compliant. And if they're not compliant after those 3 weeks, is to give penalties. And the penalties in the existing bylaws are pretty steep, as a matter of fact. They vary from $300 to $2,000. And if you're in a second offense, the range is double, from $600 to $4,000. That's the line we're following right now. We have informed people of our policy. So I think the first step is to make sure that we cover all the complaints that we have right now.
This completes this edition of Viewpoints. Our journalists this week, Karen Mosna, Megan Dooling, Ed Halverson, Taylor McClure, Erica Butler, Andrew Dow, and Sarah Gouda. National Coordinator, Maureen McEwen. Viewpoints is produced by the Community Radio Fund of Canada. My name is Boris Chassaigne. Happy to have you with us. Take care.
Anastasia Avakumova in beautiful British Columbia, and you are tuned to Viewpoints. Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI and get all our stories on canada-info.ca.